Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hello and welcome to The Sidebar, presented by True Crime Daily, taking you inside the courtrooms of high-profile and notorious cases from across the country. I'm your host, Joshua Ritter. I'm a criminal defense lawyer based in Los Angeles and previously an LA County prosecutor for nearly a decade. You can find me on all social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. We are recording this on Friday, April 19th, 2024. In this week's episode, a judge decides the fate of the Rust movie armorer recently convicted for the on-set shooting that left one crew member dead. Plus, jury selection begins for a woman charged with murdering her police officer boyfriend in a case where her attorneys claim she is the victim of a massive cover-up. But first, the discovery of two bodies ends the hopeful search for the missing Oklahoma mothers. Police now believe their deaths are related to a group calling themselves God's Misfits. Today, we are joined by Matt Timpanic, a nationally recognized defense attorney and legal commentator you can catch on the Long Crime Network and other media outlets. Matt, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Joshua.
Absolutely. I've been looking forward to this conversation because I know that you follow these cases closely. I've heard some of the commentary that you've had on the Long Crime Network, and I'm really interested to get your thoughts and perspective both as a criminal defense lawyer and as a plaintiff's attorney. So let's jump right in. We go to Texas County, Oklahoma, where the search for two missing mothers ended tragically with authorities announcing the women's murder, allegedly perpetrated by members of a fringe anti-government group. Veronica Butler and Jillian Kelly disappeared on March 30th while the women were driving to pick up Butler's children for a birthday party. At the time of their disappearance, Butler was in the midst of a contentious custody battle with the children's father. One of the women charged in the murders was the children's paternal grandmother, Tiffany Adams. Along with Adams, three other suspects implicated in the crime, Ted Cullum, Cole Twombly, and Cora Twombly, were allegedly all members of the group God's Misfits, which has religious affiliations and conducted meetings at the Twombly's residence. The suspects have all been charged with two counts each of first-degree murder and kidnapping, along with the charge of conspiracy to commit murder. In a newly unsealed affidavit following the discovery of the women's remains, authorities claim that Adams purchased stun guns from a gun store 1 week before the disappearance and also allegedly purchased three burner phones, which were all found in the vicinity of the Butler's car. According to the affidavit, a broken hammer and bloodstains were also discovered near the vehicle. However, the women's cause of death has not yet been released. Matt, we see this all the time in cases where you have multiple defendants charged with one crime. And, you know, lots of times it's in a murder case. We see the prosecution throw in a conspiracy charge. And I think it might be intuitive as to why they're doing that, but there's something more behind the strategy for the prosecution. Could you walk us through that?
Well, when you have a conspiracy case, what you need first and foremost is a meeting of the minds of at least two individuals. That is a conspiracy. It can't just be one person. By adding two people and adding a conspiracy charge, you're able to connect the dots between who committed the crime and who was maybe part of the crime and knew about it and did nothing. Remember, in a conspiracy, the right hand doesn't need to know what the left hand is doing, only that there was an understanding at one point to be actually commit this crime. When you have this kind of conspiracy charge, prosecutors love it. It is the gift that keeps on giving because it allows them to connect the two charges, the two individuals together, and leverage each or both of them against one another to be able to get the other one to flip. Remember, Oklahoma is a death penalty case. This sounds like it's going to end up being a capital case if it is in fact charged. if the individual who actually committed the crime is probably not going to be the one who's going to be flipping, but it's going to be the individual who knew about it and probably participated in some way. To do so by adding that conspiracy charge, the prosecution could use the individual who was part of it, who did not commit the crime, to testify against the other half and get a surefire conviction. Like I said, the conspiracy charge is the gift that keeps on giving for prosecutors.
Yeah, you can imagine there are some very strong-handed and difficult conversations taking place between the prosecution and the defense attorneys for some of these people involved, especially if they're the ones that they do not believe may have played a direct role in the murders, but just helped out in the planning. Hey, unless you want to spend the rest of your life in prison or possibly face the death penalty, why don't we have a little chat about how you might be able to help us out? I think you're exactly right. This case is getting a lot of attention for a number of reasons. I mean, it's always a tragedy when you have, you know, people going missing like this, and then they show up, unfortunately, dead, their mothers, everything involved. But one thing that's catching a lot of attention is that they're calling themselves God's misfits. And I don't know if they're some sort of fringe religious group. They keep on being described as an anti-government group. But do you think that alone, the idea that they had this group self-described as God's misfits, is that alone for the conspiracy in this case?
It depends. If the individuals were using kind of meetings that they have to orchestrate these events, that's possible. And that could be used to introduce and kind of connect all the dots together. But remember, a lot of when it comes to a trial, it's about, okay, what is admissible and what isn't, and what is admissible, but would have the ability to inflame or confuse the jury. When somebody hears, a jury hears God's misfits and everything, okay, now we're in an ultra extremist religious cult situation. Is that going to inflame the jury? What is the probative value of introducing that? Is that going to outweigh the prejudicial effect? So it's a very delicate balancing test. So it is, if you can connect the dots between the organization, not just the individuals, using the organization itself to coordinate these alleged murders, then that could probably be introduced into trial because there would be no reason to exclude it. It would be exceptionally important to the case, relevant, and needed to properly be able to tell the story.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is helpful to the prosecution that they already had this preformed group. One last question on this. A lot of people are saying, I understand why all these folks are charged, but if the underlying motive for this murder was this custody battle between one of the victims, Butler, and the father of her children, where's the father in all of this? Why wasn't he charged? It's one of those cases where it seems like the direct person that was involved in the dispute is not charged in the murder. And again, we are not trying to throw blame at people here if they're completely innocent, but it is a good question. And I wonder, do you think that this opens the door? There's possibly an investigation going on and possibly charges down the road.
This is important to remember. Cui bono? Who benefits? In this whole situation, who benefits with these murders? Unfortunately, it's the husband who is going through a custody battle. Does that mean for sure that he was involved in this? Absolutely not. But they're definitely, the investigation will be like, okay, did you know absolutely anything? Did you make any statements to your, I believe, mother before she allegedly committed these murders and this organization that they were part of? What was your role in this? Or did you not speak to anyone about anything? All they knew that you were in a custody battle and they picked up the pieces and did something outside of your knowledge. That's going to be very important because even if this husband had the slightest bit of inclination, like it'd be really helpful if my soon-to-be ex-wife was not in the picture for this custody battle. I think that might be enough for some kind of charges because no jury is going to believe it's like, you knew exactly what was going to happen. You already have that. You're a part of this extremist organization, and we see the result. I think that right now we can't say for sure one way or another, but it's definitely, where does the trail lead? Does it just end? Does it end with him just simply saying, it's like, well, I'm in a custody battle, and the individuals took that and did their actions without his knowledge?
Yeah, and it's very reminiscent of the Adelson case out of Florida. You had that case, not everybody was arrested all at once. You had first the direct involved people committing the murder, the people planning the murder. Then you got Charlie Adelson involved with his kind of direction and paying for the murder. And now we have mom, Donna Adelson, on trial or facing trial for the same charges. So if that's any kind of framework for how this case might play out, it wouldn't be surprising if we see other people brought in with charges down the road. So we will continue to follow that case. It's very tragic, but also very interesting from a legal perspective.
Calling all pop culture enthusiasts.
Are you obsessed with all things celebrity?
Do you live for the drama, the laughs, and the unexpected moments that unfold on social media?
Then you're going to want to tune in to the Comments by Celebs podcast.
Join us 3 times a week as we deep dive into every aspect of pop culture.
Whether it's dissecting the latest trends or just chatting about your favorite celebs, Comments by Celebs has you covered.
We have new episodes out every week. Follow and listen to Comments by Celebs on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Another interesting case out of Santa Fe, New Mexico, where the armorer on Alec Baldwin's film Rust has been sentenced following a fatal onset shooting. Hannah Gutierrez Reed received the maximum penalty of 18 months for her conviction of involuntary manslaughter and the shooting death of cinematographer Helena Hutchins. Reed was in charge of the film's prop guns, and her failure to adhere to industry standard safety practices resulted in live ammunition being fired from a gun used on set. The trigger of said gun was allegedly pulled by Alec Baldwin, who similarly faces a charge of involuntary manslaughter in the shooting, though no trial date is yet set in that case. All right, Matt, jump right in. What are your thoughts on this sentence? Did the judge get it right? It was the max, but some people are saying it's not enough time. Other folks are saying it's too much for her conduct. What are your thoughts?
I definitely think that the most likely result after hearing all the facts and the evidence was a maximum sentence of 18 months. In the state of New Mexico, involuntary manslaughter is punishable by up to 18 months. If people wanted a more stiffer sentence, they needed to charge something else, such as voluntary manslaughter, which would have higher exposure. I definitely think that I think the sentence is just based on everything that I heard and all the corners that she cut and all the indifference to human life. And I feel like I saw that post-conviction while she was incarcerated pending sentencing, she made statements about against the jury and how stupid they were. And I definitely think that plays a part of it with the judge because it shows a lack of remorse. When sentencing comes around, one of the things judges base their sentence on, especially when there was an actual victim who was harmed, not just some kind of drug charges or something where the victim is society. When there's an actual person who was involved in this, a judge wants to see real remorse that my actions led to somebody's life, entire family being changed forever. And by saying those things, you're just blaming the jury for your own actions. So I definitely think that the judge saw no sympathy on behalf of Kiana Gutierrez and sentenced her to the maximum, which I think was justified in this case.
You know, I'm so glad you brought that out about the remorse of the defendant playing a possible role in the judge's sentencing. And just from a philosophical perspective, I'm curious to hear your thoughts because it's interesting to me that you have a defendant who, and I'm not saying in this particular case, but in other cases, in a hypothetical case, is adamant about their innocence, saying, I either didn't do this thing that I'm accused of, or what I'm accused of, it doesn't satisfy the elements of the crime for whatever reason, and I shouldn't be held responsible for it. And then they're found guilty. And then we kind of, as a society, expect them to turn around and say, okay, I'm sorry. I'm really sorry for what I did. And to me, that how does that play out? Or how do you reconcile that they're supposed to do this about face and now accept their responsibility, even if they maintain their innocence, if they want to somehow affect their sentencing?
I definitely think when it comes to lack of remorse, one of the things a judge and a jury may be looking for, especially a judge when it comes to sentencing, is what have you done subsequent to your actions? It's not really I'm punishing you for going to trial. I'm punishing you for having been through the pretrial proceedings, done the trial, and you sitting here and you still, after everything that you heard that the prosecution say, you still stand there and like, well, this isn't on me. This was not my fault. And it's like, really? Because you didn't do this, and somebody died as a result. If when I was hearing the sentence being put down, I can almost say with absolute certainty, the judge would have given her more if the judge was able to, because Hannah Gutierrez's conduct, I don't even know if she flinched after a verdict. When you think about something, how high profile it is and how life-changing a verdict is, you would think some kind of emotion. And it was almost like when I saw it when it come down, she was ready for it. It's like, yeah, that's what I expected was going to happen. And it's like, if you were expecting that to happen, why aren't you creating a situation where you accept responsibility and you don't put everybody through this?
Yeah.
So I definitely think that there's not a trial tax per se, but I definitely think that Hannah Gutierrez's actions from the beginning of trial all the way through sentencing did her no favors with the judge.
Well, it sounds like you're right from the judge's reaction. All right. Let's say now you get a phone call. They say it's Alec Baldwin's defense team. They say, Matt, we need you. And you are now set to defend him. How does this conviction and this sentence play a role in the way that you respond for representing Alec Baldwin, if at all? Maybe it doesn't affect you at all.
What is good about this conviction by Hannah Gutierrez only helps Alec Baldwin. The reason is somebody's head was going to roll figuratively and literally in this case because somebody was dead. There were industry standards that weren't followed. There was extreme reckless conduct. Those are crimes. So if you're Alec Baldwin's defense team, your theory is like, hey, we got the person responsible. That individual, the armorer on set, is responsible for making sure that there are no real bullets in any of the guns. In a Western, people during takes are going to point it and shoot it at each other, like bang. And that's what I feel like happened with Alec Baldwin's case. And it's like, oh, there's an actual bullet in here. That's happened before. I think it was in the movie The Crow about 30 years ago. But it's the armorer's job to make sure there's no live ammunition on the set. I don't even know how live bullets got into a set. And if you're doing so, why every single bullet isn't checked? And if you're Alec Baldwin, you're like, I didn't know. Like, I've been on sets. I've used guns before. I was Jack Ryan years ago in The Hunt for Red October. I've used guns. I know what on set. But yet somebody else was supposed to take care of that for me. And now I'm literally have to deal with the rest of my life having shot and killed somebody entirely accidentally. But it all depends what the facts say. Did Alec Baldwin act extremely reckless? Did he know sometimes that there were live ammunition? But it definitely is going to go into what Alec Baldwin knew and how his actions led to the death of the cinematographer on set on that day and on the set of Rust.
Yeah, I have said that if I were on his defense team, I would be spending time finding out how many times he has ever filmed a movie, TV show, what have you, where he's had to handle a gun, figure out how many times he's been handed a gun on set. And it's got to be hundreds, if not thousands of times that he's been handed a prop gun on set and never had an issue. And now this one time we're saying that you're responsible because you didn't double check what you were already told was a safe gun. And I know people are going to jump into the comments and say, it's not true that he was told it was safe. He still has a responsibility. He was the producer. I agree with all of that. But this comes down to a criminal mindset, not a civil negligence mindset, but a criminal mindset of gross negligence and indifference. And I don't know if you can get there when you've got an actor who expects that they're using a prop gun. So I think it's a much more difficult case. I agree. And I think you make excellent points and we will continue to follow that case. It's going to be coming up pretty soon here. It should be very interesting, especially if it goes to trial, which all signs kind of point towards that as we sit here today. Let's turn finally to Canton, Massachusetts, where supporters of a woman accused of killing her police officer boyfriend lined up in droves as her trial began last week with jury selection. Karen Reed faces a second-degree murder charge for the death of her former partner, John O'Keefe. Prosecutors claim Reed hit the man with her SUV before leaving him to die in the snow. Reed's supporters and defense, however, contend that she is the victim of an elaborate police cover-up and that other officers may have been involved in the conspiracy. A 200-foot buffer zone has been imposed around the courthouse for protesters, but Reed supporters are fighting the measure in the state's highest court. The local notoriety of the case has affected the process of selecting jurors, with many locals already forging their own conclusions on the matter. In the third day of jury selection, 57 prospective jurors appeared, 41 of whom had heard of the case, with 20 indicating that they had already formed an opinion. Jury selection should be finalized by the time you're listening to this, with the trial expected to take between 6 to 8 weeks after the jurors are seated. Matt, let's jump into this first, this concept of the free speech and freedom of assembly and how it conflicts with the ability of a courthouse and a judge to put on a fair trial. It is rare to see this kind of public response and attention and fervor surrounding a case that doesn't involve celebrities, but it is happening in this case, and it has to be addressed, and it's already caused apparently issues with perhaps witness intimidation. But the supporters of Karen Reed are saying, hey, we have a right to do this. We have a right to assemble and voice our opinions on this whole thing. How do you play that all out in your head?
I think the best way is give kind of the listeners a constitutional law 101 analysis. Okay. What we're dealing here is a situation of time, place, and manner, which is often dealing with protesting near public buildings, with at the courthouse on an issue of public concern. This was police corruption in a public trial. In this case, you have to weigh the safety of the jurors not to be harassed against the individual protesting's First Amendment right. And I think this would trigger what we call strict scrutiny, and that the state would need a compelling interest. So the theory being is that the protecting the jurors from intimidation of these potential protesters outweighs those protesters' First Amendment rights. I definitely think that it's a situation that the SJC in Massachusetts, the Supreme Judicial Court, is going to look at ear on the side of the constitutional rights of the protesters, mainly because I think there are situations to protect the jurors. It will definitely be it's slightly burdensome. It's not going to be unduly burdensome, but I definitely think that we might, depending on the notoriety of the case, and I am predicting a full social media day in and day out circus inside and outside the courtroom. It might be a situation where jurors are sequestered and they're brought in by a bus and they're dropped off right near the back of the courthouse, where that they're just walking in, maybe under like a canopy or something like that, to prevent this situation, which would allow the protesters outside the courthouse to exercise their First Amendment rights.
You make a really good point, because television cameras are going to be inside broadcasting this whole thing, but one thing they will not show are the jurors. However, if you're sitting inside the courtroom, they're not behind some sort of partition. You can see all these folks. And if you are a protester who shows up every day and shows up to court and shows up outside the courthouse every single day, you're going to recognize these folks if they're walking in. And I think you're right. I don't know if we're in the days of an actual sequester where people are put in hotel rooms, but some sort of protection needs to be set up for these people to come and go from court without just being constantly, not even harassed, but just chirped at by these people who are surrounding the courthouse. Let's say those provisions are put in place, and let's say we finally get through jury selection, and now all the jurors are sworn, and it's witness number one has taken the stand. Do you think all of that noise kind of goes to the side, and they're going to be able to concentrate on this case and decide it based upon the facts and evidence? Or is that noise going to play a role in their heads?
I definitely think the noise is going to play a role in both their heads. Given the high publicity of this case, and every single day gets more and more. You go on social media, the Free Karen Reed people and the Justice for John O'Keefe, it is deafening what is going on. I've followed trials for numerous years, tried 40 of them myself, and I have never seen, maybe outside of the Depp v. Heard trial, I have never seen a following of people who have true crime junkies, social media sleuths, trying to crack the case before this case even starts. Remember, until the first witness takes the stand, we don't really know anything. That's the witness stand is the only place where testimony and evidence can come. It doesn't come from the attorneys. When opening statements start, that's not evidence. And the judge reminds everybody, including the jury, that what the attorneys say are not evidence. So I definitely think that as this trial grows and grows and the notoriety continues and it's get picked up by more news organizations and it's got more engagement on social media, I definitely think it's going to enter into the thoughts of both parties. But as a prosecutor or as a defense attorney, and you and I have been both, the key is keep it on the facts and evidence and try your case. Don't listen to anything else.
Very well said. To your point, I've said this before on this show, but there's a very vast sometimes difference between what the universe is of everything surrounding a case and what the universe is of the facts and evidence that will be presented in court. And this case has a lot of that, has that in abundance, because we have heard conspiracies about the cover-up and how did the taillight get broken and who else was involved and are those dog bites and all of this other kind of stuff that people seem to already, it's in the common vocabulary surrounding this case. But it's still to be determined how much of this will actually be presented to the jury, which brings me to my question. One of the big issues here is what in Massachusetts they call third-party culprit liability or a defense. I'm in California. We call it third-party culpability. Same concept, but it's this idea that my client is not only saying that they didn't do it, they're saying this other person is responsible and the police never looked at that person and therefore you should find me not guilty because the police didn't do their job. That's kind of what's at play here. But the judge hasn't quite ruled on it, has left the door open just a sliver, but has said, I feel, and the judge, this was the judge's words I'm trying to summarize, that she feels it's well within her rights to deny that argument, deny any evidence of that based upon what she's heard so far, but she will allow the defense to try to develop that through the course of the trial, but they're not going to be able to talk about it in opening statements, which is where they would want to lay the groundwork for this whole theory. How do you think that plays out for the defense? Is this a huge blow, or do you think they're going to be able to kind of pivot and parry and work that into their case anyways?
Well, since this trial is going to be like an episode of The Practice, the TV show, which actually takes place in Boston following a criminal defense firm, I think it's best to talk about what they usually practice. And it was called Plan B, which is the same thing, point the finger at somebody else. By this third-party defense, like you were saying, David Yannetti and Alan Jackson are going to be trying to build the foundation through the prosecution's case that somebody else killed John O'Keefe. They're going to be using the investigation, that the conflict of interest and the fact that evidence wasn't getting for years and that evidence planting. They need to be able to lay a legitimate foundation that it is reasonable. If it's, remember, when we're doing jury instructions and it talks about reasonable doubt, it's you need to believe the doubt is reasonable. As such, the same argument applies for a third party defense. It has to be a reasonable belief that somebody else did this, not just arguing, like throwing anything against the wall and seeing if it would stick. The defense is going to have to use the Commonwealth's witnesses and get the questions out of them to open the mere possibility that this is reasonable. If they do, then when they start their case, then they can lay the foundation for it. Without it, without the third party culpability defense, I think it's very difficult to be able to get an acquittal. With it, they have a fighting chance.
Yeah, I think this was a huge blow, setback for the defense, even in keeping it out of opening statements. Because, like you said, the words of the attorneys are not evidence, but opening statements are like a preview to the film. And if you are able to give jurors a roadmap of what you intend to prove and what your theory of the case is, that kind of signals things to them that when they occur in court, they go, aha, that's what he was talking about in opening statements, or, oh, that's why this is important on cross-examination, why he's asking all of this. But without that, operating more in a vacuum for the defense, is it going to be harder for jurors to realize the importance of some of this questioning? I think it is. What are your thoughts?
I definitely think that remember, during opening statements, you're not arguing. You're just trying to say what the facts are going to show. And I definitely think how the defense is going to do an opening statements, they're going to do a quasi under the table, third party defense, lay the foundation for it. It's like, they didn't do this, they didn't do that. Here's this kind of connection that they had, this kind of relationship. We didn't get this. They're going to basically lay the foundation. Like, here's everything the Commonwealth just told you about their case. Our argument right now, our opening statement is, wait, don't rush to judgment. Don't take them at their word. Hold them to their burden, and we will show you all the places where we believe reasonable doubt exists. One of the biggest points of contention will be the Google search. Did it occur at 2:30 or whatever it was in the morning, or was it 5:24 when John O'Keefe's body eventually was found? That's going to be an issue. When they found his body, there was green grass underneath the snow. There was a huge amount of snow on that day. It was a whiteout blizzard. But when they picked up his body, allegedly, there was green grass underneath. So was his body there before the snow began, or was there only a short amount of time that it actually was still warm and melted the snow beneath him? All of these issues are going to come into play. Remember, this is in criminal cases, facts win cases. Who has the better facts, who has the more cohesive facts, usually wins.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting case because it has all of those elements that create such intrigue from a true crime fan perspective. But you're right, you know, the tail light, when was that broken? The snow under his body, would that be there or not? That Google search could mean vastly different things depending on when it was performed. Was it before or after his body was discovered? All can change this case. It will be an interesting one. We are looking forward to covering it for everyone. So they have not quite sworn in as the time of this recording, all of the jurors. They expect to have that happen early next week. And maybe we will be having opening statements by the time you are hearing this podcast released. But in the meantime, Matt, we are so thankful for you coming on this week. Where can people find out more about you?
You can follow me all forms of social media at Tim Panic Law, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and as well as at my website, www.timpaniclaw.com.
Fantastic. Again, it was a pleasure. Thank you. I'm your host, Josh Ritter. You can find me on all social media at Joshua Ritter ESQ or at joshuaritter.com. You can find our sidebar episodes wherever you get your podcasts, and we want to hear from you. If you've got questions or comments you'd like us to address, tweet us your questions with the hashtag TCD Sidebar. And thank you for joining us at the True Crime Daily Sidebar.